May the words of my mouth and thoughts of my heart be acceptable before you, Hashem, my rock and redeemer. Shalom and welcome all to our Kosher Torah open forum. I am, of course, your host, Ariel Bar Tzadok. We are now continuing our lessons in classical Kabbalah, the pre-Lurianic systems. And tonight, we are going to talk about an interesting concept called the Ten Sefirot. Now, we've discussed the Ten Sefirot in a previous lesson in this class. We've discussed it in the Gateway to Kabbalah series. I have numerous material on this available in writing and in other audio forums. But I'm going to repeat it here because it's in our book to do so, and endeavor, as I pray I've had in other places, to make this concept understandable and introduce to you a very curious insight that our author brings that I've never seen anywhere else, and it's rather good, but we'll get to that in a minute. First off, let's understand things. Sefirot, generally speaking, generically speaking, they're called the divine attributes, how God reveals himself in creation. They are not expressions of God, but what is called in later Kabbalah, the vessels through which his infinite, ultimate, pure light shines. Kind of like, if you will, different shades of color for the light to shine through. Think of it, if you will, like you have a light bulb, God's light, and it's shining through different glasses. So you have it, it's going to come through the green, it's going to look green. It's going to come through the blue, it's going to look blue. And the purpose of these different shades are to express everything and the multiplicities within the divine. That's pretty much how it's understood. Now, what's interesting is how these understandings have come to be viewed in its variant forms. The Sefirot as a concept are originally found in Judaic literature in the Sefer Yetzirah. They're referred to as the Ten Sefirot Belima. I referred to and discussed that in previous lessons. I encourage you to go and get them. And then we find later literature, Zoharic literature, and later Spanish-oriented philosophical Kabbalistic literature, wherein which teachings of the Sefirot become rather expanded, explained, if you will, even diagnosed. This entire school endeavors to explain the unexplainable, but I should say, that has become the norm today. So when you speak to anybody trained in the traditional later schools of the Kabbalah, and you mention the Sefirot, they'll tell you there are 10 within 10, then there are parts of Fim, and then there are Olamot, then there are parts of Fim within the Olamot, and then there are Olamot within the parts of Fim, then there are Hechalot within the parts of Fim within the Olamot, and on 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 it goes. I love to take the people and say, okay, hold on. What is a Sefirah? What exactly is it? Can I touch it? If it's a vessel, then it should have some kind of form, right? Well, what exactly is a Sefirah? I have shown in previous lessons in this series and elsewhere that this concept of trying to explain this relationship of what we call Surah v'chomer, force and form, has much foundations in Pythagorean and later Platonic Greek philosophy. That's just true. You can argue that all you want. A person who does the research will just see it's there. Done. But originally, the Sefirot do exist. They're not just philosophical constructs. But if they do exist, then what is the nature of their existence? We can talk about them, but we're never going to get them. And I will give you some understandings and insights into this. We know, for example, by scientific principle today, that there are four major energy principles in operation. There is the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, electromagnetic force or energy, and gravity. Okay. I believe that science can show the effects of gravity, show the effects of electromagnetic energy, show the effects of the weak and the strong nuclear force. Got it. But now that you can show these forces, my question is, can you actually show the forces themselves? I understand that you can show me in a lab the effects of all these things. Got it. But I want to see gravity. I don't want to see the effects of gravity. I want to see it. Show me it. What does it look like? What is the strong magnetic, weak magnetic force? What color is it? What form is it? Is it a solid? Is it a liquid? Is it a gas? Is it plasma? What exactly is it? Show it to me. I want to see a picture on the internet. I want to see a video of it on YouTube. Show it to me. If I start talking like this to a scientist, they're going to look at me like I'm some dumb country bumpkin who just doesn't understand. There's a comment here in text that says, through its behavior is how it's observed. You got it! And so exactly it is with Sephirot. The concept of that which exists, which we can see but we can't see, should not confuse us or make us deny its reality. Hey, that rhymes. I'm a poet and I don't know it. My feet show it. They're Longfellows. Anyway, I know. I love to tell jokes. I don't know if people get my jokes or something. You know, I guess that's what comes with the territory of being a little bit eccentric. I guess you meditate for too long and you kind of get that way. And I think that's just fine. We all should lighten up a bit. But anyway, getting back to business here. I'm introducing to us this concept as a foundation. Because if you ever want to experience gravity, I'll tell you exactly how to do it. Go to the top of the structure in which you live and step off the roof. I guarantee, I don't care how high up you are, you will experience gravity. Everybody knows that, yes? It's a law. You will fall. And for those of the Christian persuasion who want to say, I'm under grace, not under law, well, you go tell that to gravity and see if you can get gravity to be persuaded that the next time you jump off a roof, not to fall, because that's not really nice. Grace. Yeah, you go, ah. Okay. Now, you understand my point? When we're talking about energy fields, these things do exist, and they have influence. If we understand and acknowledge by present insight that there are four major forces, I will postulate that there are probably 10 times, 4 times, 4 times, 4, however many more. Science acknowledges today the existence of matter that they don't understand, so they call it dark matter. They acknowledge the existence of energy that they don't understand, and they call it dark energy. And they say it takes up the vast majority of the universe. Now, what they do know and don't know, what's publicly revealed and not publicly revealed, whatever. That's not our concern. What our concern is what is revealed. Now, understand the nature of revelation, because it's important with regards to Sephirot. Where does all this information come from? You think some guy is just like hanging out in a cave, running away from the Romans because they want to kill him, or something similar. And he says, gee, I got nothing else better to do than to sit here buried in my neck into the sand. What should I think about? Well, gee, I'm missing all my best programs on cable. I don't know what's going on in the news because our internet connection here in the cave is really bad. So what can I do? I just think I'll wonder about what's happening in the greater universe. And all of a sudden, the stuff just came into a guy's head like he's making it all up? No. In order to understand physics, you have to understand biology. And in order to understand biology, you have to understand psychology. And in order to understand psychology, you must understand that which we call today spirituality. They are links in a chain. They are all connected. They are all one. I'm not the only one who says this. When we come to understanding Sephirot, do not try to understand them scientifically. Do not even try to understand them intellectually. I don't even know if understanding is an appropriate term. How do you understand a fundamental force in nature? For example, we all know that there are things called cosmic fields. Whenever I watch science programs about the planet Earth and outer space, they always show these big, grand diagrams and images of the Earth's magnetic field, or these invisible lines going all around the planet. Gee, I never saw any of them. But they're there. Well, every planet has them. Every solar system has them. Every star has them. And these influences of these forces go far and wide. And they send out their influences. And their influences are felt in the world of physics, in the world of biology, in the world of psychology, in the world of spirituality. These influences at the psychological and spiritual level are what we call revelations in meditation, and I might add, the influences of what we call astrology. Astrology is not a predictive form to try to understand the future for one reason. And this actually is a very significant difference between Torah teachings and Vedic teachings of the Hindu tradition. The Vedic traditions of the Hindu tradition, the Vedic teachings, pretty much state we all are familiar with the term called karma. What goes around, comes around. Well, in the Torah way, things are much more quantum in nature. In other words, they're much more fluid. We have a concept, as we know, called Teshuvah. Teshuvah translates as repentance, but it's much more than that. In that it means a fundamental shift of your relationship to the cosmic fields and energies around. We influence them at every moment. Those influences can come and bounce back to us, kind of like sonar. Things go out and they bounce back, come back to us. That's karma. We can shift our location, and that which projects out doesn't necessarily have to come back, positive or negative, depending on how we shift and move in things. So, the concepts of Rosh Hashanah, the new year, new beginnings, all are influenced by us and can therefore, by our behaviors, shift our, in quote, place to relocate us outside of the domain where in which the bounce back effect of our own external energies going out will not affect us upon returning back. That means karma can be neutralized. Now, the nature of the fundamental universal energies, which we call Sephirot, like I said, materialize in the world of physics, materialize in the world of biology, materialize in the world of psychology, materialize in the world we call spirituality. Let's not use that word spirituality. And let's refer to it as the realm of the mind. But psychology is also the realm of the mind. We have two realms when we discuss the mind. Well, yes, and every psychologist who's worth their weight in psychology knows there's what we call the conscious and the unconscious. The great problem today with modern psychology and psychotherapy is that it is usually behaviorally oriented. In other words, it's become rather, oh, what's a nice way to describe it? Repressive. Bottom line, psychology is manipulated today to get people to think that they're supposed to act and believe in a certain way. So therefore, if you do not accept certain political and social agendas which are politically correct, obviously there's something wrong with you, and therefore you have to be persuaded to think in their way. This abuse of psychology and psychotherapy, which is unfortunately rampant here in the United States and Western world today, had its origins in Soviet Russia, in which if you believed in capitalism, you were mentally ill. And indeed, such ideas are quickly becoming considered disturbing today. Truth is becoming lies, lies is becoming truth. Getting back to business. Real psychology deals with understanding that we have a conscious and an unconscious. And as such, the unconscious, we learn about this more so in the writings of Carl Jung. I will encourage you, if you're interested in reading the writings of people like Erich Neumann, who is the professor of psychiatry in Tel Aviv University. He was one of the leading students of Carl Jung, for those who, in my opinion, wrongfully claimed Jung was anti-Semitic. You can read the writings of Edward Edinger, a great post-Jungian from here in the United States. Good stuff. Easy to understand, in my opinion, stuff. To help you understand the nature of what goes on inside of us. Because it is taught that we are created in the image of these Sephirot. So rather than try to understand them outside there in a greater universe in ways in which I cannot touch and feel and know and experience, I understand from the verse in Job, Mebasari Echaza Eloha, from my flesh will I know God. I look into the human experience, and by understanding how my humanity, our humanity works, and how we are created in God's image, then the Sephirot, which are said to be the image in which we are created, I understand from within us. I understand that we are individual expressions of a greater composite pattern. And therefore, we are in the image of the universe. No, we are not the universe. No, we are not God. But we are, if you will, a photocopy, a JPEG image, shrunk down, and that if you could expand it all and look at it all, you would see a reflection of the whole. That's pretty much a good description of this. So when we come to understand Sephirot, I endeavor to understand them within the realm of mind, psychology, including what we call the conscious and the unconscious, and we're going to see that reflection in the Sephirot themselves, and we're going to learn about ourselves within this context. Is this philosophical? It can be, even though I personally prefer not to go in that direction. But like the Sefer Yetzirah said, and I taught in that course, it is bulimia. They are, without being able to put into a concrete form, they have what we call tsura, force, but no homer, form. And yet we're going to learn, as we get into this, that indeed they have some structure of form, though not by any stretch of the imagination of what we would call anyways physical. Things can have form without being physical. You have a thought? Think a thought. Does that thought have a form in your head? I certainly hope so. Whereas at the same time, there's nothing you're going to be able to extract from your brain to show me that thought in action before. You can act on the thought, but you can't take the mind out of the brain and show it to me. Modern science has a big problem with that one. But that's their self-imposed limitations. With this long introduction, let's get into the section now called Sha'ar HaMidot, the gateway of explaining the attributes, the Sefirot. And I refer to this class as beginnings. A question that is asked here in text: are thoughts energy? By all means. Thoughts are things. Let's move on. Kol elu ha-devarim she'amarnu hem ha-ktama. All the things that we've been discussing now are an introduction. Kedei she'nichnas b'viur ha-chidush ha-olam. So we can talk about the renewal, the creation of the world. She'koldem kol levar hitzil chidush sura bilvad. Before our world began, before everything came into being, what we would call the Big Bang, there existed what's called tsura bilvad, the image or the force before the form. And it is interesting, when you learn about modern science and they talk about the Big Bang, how now they seem to talk about what happened before the Big Bang. They claim, according to modern understanding, that our universe is kind of like a membrane. It's kind of like this shaky, movie-flowing curtain, for lack of a better word, just hanging out there. And it's moving in whatever it moves in. And there's another curtain, or what they call a membrane, next to it. Our universe is empty. This universe is full. And at a certain point, the full universe connects to the empty universe and it spews into it. At that moment, boom! All the energy, and that was the Big Bang. But pretty much how it's described in Kabbalistic understandings. We call that other universe Yetzirah, and ours Asiya. And the Big Bang, whether it was 13, 14 billion years ago, however else time is measured, being that time is relative, you can't really say. Well, that was the beginning of this physical realm. And before it, there was another realm. So this is where I, contradict people like Professor Hawking, who say, well, the universe was created by the laws of nature. And I say, well, if you have laws of nature, then you obviously have a lawgiver. And maybe Professor Hawking would agree, okay, whatever we call that lawgiver, wherever these laws of nature came from that other parallel universe. I agree. And then we're going to say, where did it get into that universe? And we're going to say, well, it came from the one that came before it, and came before it, all the way back to the source. And what I call the source, I never wanted to refer to God as some type of person. God is not a person. God is not a king. God is not a father. God is certainly not a he or a she. We use all of these symbolic metaphors to personify and to give human characteristics to that which is certainly far above our humanity. But at the same time, we are the JPEG image of that greater, higher realm. Now, this is what we must focus on. I call God consciousness of existence. I think that's properly reflected within the name Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, which we learned means being in action. I discussed that in my Yud-Kei Vav-Kei seminar, available on koshertorah.com, and we, of course, do all the meditative techniques to try to get you in touch with this collective archetypal foundation. God is what I call the collective consciousness of creation. And we are part of that. And being part of that, we are thus in contact with everything, everywhere, simultaneously. And I remember watching some science show somewhere that modern science understands that concept and is working on it now. Our physical brains keep our attention focused on what's physically in front of us. However, beyond that which the eye sees and the ear hears, there's far more perception. I have watched shows. One of my favorite programs that I will encourage you to watch is, I believe, on the Science Channel called Through the Wormhole, hosted by Morgan Freeman. Excellent review of modern scientific principles. And they have shown things in that program which are remarkable. And if you pay attention to these things, as opposed to the nonsense going on, the political channels and all that talk and everything else, you'll actually learn something about us. Now, Sephiroth, the image, the force before the form. So rightly can we quote Star Wars and say, do not underestimate the power of the force. The force is real. Unlike Mr. Lucas, who says that life creates the force. Excuse me, he said the force creates life. Right? Life creates it. No. Life, source of life, is the source. I'm misquoting it. I'm getting my words mixed up here, and I apologize because I'm thinking back to the 1977 Star Wars film, how it was described there, and frankly, that's irrelevant. So forgive me for digressing in an unnecessary tangent. Life pre-exists creation. That is consciousness. It's sentient. It is the ultimate foundational energy, which in our language we call here light, or. And this force which existed, which manifests the light, as we say in all the different colors, we call here the Sephirot. But now our author defines this term Sephirot, not like we find it elsewhere as related to the number, to the words Sefer, meaning book, or Mispar, meaning number. He says here, and I quote, Nikra'u Sephirot me'lashon Sapiriot, that the Sephirot are named after the word Sapir, which is sapphire. Me'lashon, and he quotes here the verse from Exodus 34:10, Tahat reglav ke ma'aseh lifnat ha-sipir. The vision that the elders of Israel had at Sinai, that beneath the feet of God, they saw what appeared like a work of sapphire brick, or paved sapphire, or forming sapphire. And it's a strange term which is subject to many different interpretations for those who have never seen it and don't know it and don't get it, and therefore they just guess what it could possibly mean. And he continues and says here, Perusho, what does this mean? Loven sepiriot, that it has like this whiteness of sapphire, and he says, Shehu urdak ad, that it is a very refined light. Velo ki'ur olam ha-shafal, it's not like physical light in this world. Ela ur she'enu musag l'shum b'riah, this is a light that is not graspable by anything in creation. What is this light? This is the light of original consciousness, sentience, life. It is the source. In Old Hebrew, which is in the later Kabbalah, they call it the Ein Sof. It is the ultimate true reality of God. And as such, it is unknowable in any way other than through what it itself wishes to express and be revealed. This is a vital point for us to understand, because remember we said we want to understand the spirit as ourselves? Well, this is this number one lesson. And where I'm going with this, you'll get in, I guess, just a second. Let me continue. He says here, Uperush, what does it mean when it says beneath his feet? Remez bo al ha sefirah esarit shehu sof amidot. He says this here is referring to the final tenth sefirah, which is called the end, or the final of the attributes. The Im Esrit can, if this is true of the tenth, or Rishon Vashar al Ka al Achat Kama Vakama. This is true of the first light, then it's true of tenth light, it's true of the first light and all the rest, as he's about to explain. Now let me explain. Remember we were talking about how we had like our parallel membranes or veils or curtains, and how one bumps into the other? Well, this bump, this dimension, which we call Asiya, this is the considered to be the tenth dimension, the tenth parallel world. Is that an actual number or a symbolic number? Whatever. It's irrelevant. It is what it is. That's what we'll understand. And we say that this world of ours is what we call the physical. Oh, you know, physical is, you know, knock on wood or knock on your head, if it's wood, whatever. Within this world of physicality, of matter, there are other dimensions. And I'm not talking about the dimensions, or maybe I am talking about the dimensions of dark matter, dark energy, and I'll give you an example of them because we all know them very well. How about the dimensions of emotion, thought, dreams? Are they real? Well, I certainly hope so. Anyone here who has a loved one, I hope that you truly have a understand and know what love is. It's a feeling. Show it to me. No, don't show me its expression or its action. Extract it. Take a picture of it. Don't say love is like. I don't want any metaphors or similes. All right. I have a chair. I could show you my chair. I got a truck. I could show you my truck. I have love. Show it to me. There is gravity. Show it to me. You're not going to show me gravity. You're not going to show me love. You're not going to show me a thought. You're not going to show me a dream. You're not going to show me mind. You'll show me the expressions of all of these things, but you're not going to show it. Because it is not, in quote, showable. It's expressionable. You can see an expression of it, but you ain't going to see it. We all understand this, I hope. We all acknowledge this, I hope. The nature of our universe is that it is matter, physical. And in this physical, there are higher and lower realms of matter. Didn't we just say that science understands that there's something called this dark matter and dark energy? Not dark in like in the dark side of the force. Oh, that's so lovely to go there with Star Wars, but that's not what we're talking about. At least I don't think so, or what I'm not willing to reveal. But there's a lot about form that we do not yet understand. And this livnat ha-sapir, the dimensional expression or revelation at Sinai, was to show us the intimate connection of the dimensional planes of these two curtains. Even though they bopped and touched at one time, causing the Big Bang, these two are continually in relationship with one another. I personally believe that every time there is a black hole, it is an opening to that universe and back to this, and as science knows, there are black holes are all over the place, big ones and little ones. It is like a knitting which binds the parallel universes, which these two membranes are referred to in the Bible as the heavens and the earth, both created by a higher force called Elohim, which we're going to learn about as we go along. So, continuing. Lotomar, She'im Lotomar, Ken, if we say that this relationship is not true, She'amad Seal, call them Kol Devar Surat Olam, that the emanator originally had the force which gave rise to the form, right? And we call this original force, the original, Sechel Pashut, just simple, pure mind. How can we therefore have form without a former? How can therefore we have structure without one who makes structure? How can we have laws of nature without a lawgiver? That's pretty much his point here. And again, we understand this is a relationship. Everything in relationship to one another. There is consciousness. Consciousness is what directs and drives all things. That is what we must understand. And consciousness exists within everything, even that which we call the inanimate. There are higher and lower levels of consciousness, that's true. But even the rock that you kick, the air that you breathe, the water that you drink, is all conscious. Everything is conscious. And in later Kabbalistic literature, we get into very involved details with understanding these things. We call them sparks of holiness, Nitzotzei Kedusha, and we make conscious effort to make sure that those, in quote, Nitzotzei Kedusha are, in quote, elevated, or in other words, reunited with their source in force, so that they will no longer be entrapped and limited in expression, but can be fluid in motion. That is the way of nature. Now he writes, Seder Atzilut HaSefirot Me'or HaMon, the order of the emanation of these Sefirot from the original primordial light. Please remember this Sechel Pashut, this Ein Sof, the primordial light. Original primordial consciousness. Original primordial consciousness is what we call unknown and unknowable. If we refer to it as the original primordial light, don't consider this to be light white. Consider it black. Don't consider black as in concealed. Don't consider it to be conscious as we understand. Consider it to be unconscious, simply because it is unknown and unknowable. Now, do you, we, have an unconscious? Yes, obviously. Is it existing at this very moment? Yes, obviously. Well, what's going on in there right now? I don't know. You don't know. Well, I don't know and you don't know. How do we know? I don't know. How do we know that gravity is there, or the strong and weak force is there, or the electromagnetic force? It's there! Well then, show it to me. All right, we're going back to showing things that we can't see. Well, I can show you an expression of it. Well, that's true. I can show you an expression of my unconscious, we call it, coming out through the conscious. Right? These should be easily understandable concepts that we should all be able to grasp. But we should always understand that there's something deep within us which moves and is unseeable and unknowable. And our purpose is to try to come in contact with it. How? Not through the consciousness. If you're trying to understand and grab it and say, now I understand, then you're on the wrong path. If you want to read this book, then you better close its cover. If you want to see these words, you better close your eyes, because they're not going to be written on a page. They're not going to be seen with your physical eye. They can only be seen when your eye is closed and your mind, your heart, your unconscious is open. This is how the primordial light flows into us. That's why I call it, from our point of view, the original consciousness. It's there. And I'm just going to paraphrase this little section here. It says, when it arose within God's desire to create the world from his purpose, there was no need for him to do it. It was then that was revealed of all things the primordial light, a light which no one other than the original consciousness, God itself. Itself. Don't call him a he. Come on, let's be a little bit more spiritually mature here. Alright? It can only know. We call this the first light. It is the ultimate source. It has no beginning. It has no end. It has no up. It has no down. It has no nothing. Because we cannot say anything about it. It is the ultimate nothing. Nothing. And that's why we call it Ain or nothing. Now, here's where we get into a real interesting little philosophical discussion. This primordial reality, primordial consciousness, is before anything is. So we refer to it as that which is not. And from that which is not comes that which is. Oh, that can get really fun and confusing. But try not to get confused. From this primordial light comes what's called the first light. And we know the first light from all of our other sources called the Keter, the crown, the primordial source of individuality. And now here's an interesting question. Well, what's really the difference between the two? What's the real difference between the Ein Sof and the Keter? Are they really one and the same, kinda? Are they completely separate? This is a discussion which is discussed in all Kabbalistic literature. You'll find it discussed by Rabbi Moshe Cordovero in his famous Pardes Ha'Rumonim. You'll find it discussed by Rabbi Chaim Vital in his Etz Chaim. And ultimately, the philosophical conclusion is that the Keter is part of the Ein Sof, and the Ein Sof is part of the Keter, kind of like one flows into the other. And I will explain it, I believe, in a way that I think, as much as intellect can understand, is accurate. We are part of the whole. And yet we are individuals within the whole. Where does our individual self begin and our individual self end and blend with the collective? We say it the source. That source we call the crown. That's what Keter is. Now, we're taught that all humanity, all of Adam, are included in one greater super soul of Adam. And we're all individual sparks in the soul of greater Adam. Now, a lot of people bander that one about, but they never really take it to the logical conclusion. All souls of humanity are collected in a hive mind. And that is what we are, a hive mind. At the ultimate source, what we call the Keter, all of us are connected to the higher level. Okay? The Keter level is referred to in later literatures, Adam Kadmon, primordial man. It's not a person. I've heard Christian mystics try to refer to it as Yeshu. Please, come on, that's not what it is all about. Okay? This Keter level is the ultimate source wherein which the human soul taps into the greater collective. All of us have it. Can we be aware of it? Well, no, you can't. Why? Because it's above awareness. It's the source. It's the plug that goes into the wall behind the wall. That's where it receives electricity, if you will. And you can't see it. You can't feel it. You can't understand it. You can't know what it just is. It is that which is above Nisil Dekar, who said, I think, therefore I am. This is above thinking. At this level, Rabbi Moshe Cordovero says, this is above question. It is above answer. Can we actually get into the Keter level? Yeah, you can. But it's nothing that you'll ever be able to put your finger on and say, wow, that was the Keter level. That was very cool. Gee, I'm going to draw a picture of it. Well, no, you're not. If you experience Keter, when you become conscious again, you'll know, I was somewhere. I experienced something. And from it, like everything else, you'll be able to draw an expression thereof. But you'll never be able to touch it itself. You can tell me what you are thinking about, but you cannot show me thought. You can express to me what you love, but you cannot show me love itself. Essence is the same thing. That is Cantor. Now, a little digression here about souls. This is not its place, but I'm going to discuss it here just as a quick mention, because later lessons we're going to do this. All human souls, we call souls, are true essences, ultimately part of a greater hive mind. Now, we all think that that means that we here physically on our planet, therefore, are all one. Okay? That's true. But now, let's expand the envelope. All of our souls emanate from a source. And as those souls emanate into multiple other forms through the force that they flow, our soul, your and my soul, is a collective, which means my soul is in you or somebody else. And whatever my soul can right now be inhabiting 100 different bodies. And we are all sparks of a greater spark, a subjective part of the greater supersoul. And that's why certain souls always feel a camaraderie together. If you're here at Kosher Torah with me, and I with you, somehow we're connected. That means our souls are probably somehow connected in an intimate connection. We might be part of the greater soul body. But now, you really want to get interesting? Share with you an interesting little teaching. Each one of our souls, as we know, has a higher self and a lower self. This is referred to in all meditative literature. It's psychological literature. Carl Jung refers to the higher self as the inner self. And we're always taught how to get in touch with it so as to be in touch with our higher self, to be guided. And that's, of course, what the whole spiritual path and Torah is all about. Well, according to this teaching, when Adam, remember him? Collective soul of all humanity. He wasn't a human being. He wasn't a physical person. He was a collective. It says that Adam ate of the fruit in the forbidden tree in the Garden of Eden. Remember the story, Genesis? Well, according to this, there was an entire level of souls within the original Adam which refused to partake of the eating of the fruit of the forbidden tree, and therefore did not fall and stayed above in their original station. Those souls of humanity, of Adam, are collectively referred to as Metatron. Metatron is a collective, as are we. That's why you'll find that Metatron has many names. Metatron is Michael. Metatron is Gabriel. Metatron is Raziel. Metatron is many different, because they're all expressions of the collective, as are we. This is a big secret here. Now remember, our higher selves are those angels. They are our guardian angels. Our higher selves are Mazal. Mazal. The influence upon us which guides us below, and also somehow related to astrology. Well, they're not necessarily astrology. They are a higher influence. Somebody in text here is asking an old question, though he probably doesn't know how old it is. He's saying, well, wait a second. Don't we have a whole body of literature that said Enoch ascended above and became Metatron? Right? How is that? This is actually a question that was asked, a long time, 1,000 years ago, by one of the famous Talmudic commentaries called the Tosafot, where in which there's a reference to the Metatron. They say, wait a second. If Metatron is revealed to have been this primordial source that was with God in the beginning, souls of humanity. How could Enoch, who's in the seventh generation of man, been there before man was created? And they answer by saying the Metatrons existed first, and Enoch ascended to become above. Essentially, Enoch transcended his physical mortal coil and reunited with his source above. That is all our destinies. Okay? This is what we're getting into here. So now let's continue into understanding the Keter. We're going to go through these. We'll get into all the details as we need to. And however long it takes us, so be it. Now let's get back to discussing the first light. We said that this emanates from the radiance of his glory. Remember, from the original dark light, the original unknowable, comes an expression, comes an extension, which in itself is dark light. This is the beginning of the individuation process of the multiple manifestations, the infinite expressions of the infinite. Where's the line that demarcates and separates between the Keter and the Ein Sof? Good question. You can go into all the Lauriana Kabbalah and they'll tell you about the Kav of the Ein Sof, the line of the light of the infinite, which goes into the first dimension, the domain called Adam Kadmon, all kinds of discussions and whatever. It's not graspable by intellect, so don't bother to. So, he relates an example how to understand this. He says, think about lighting one candle from the next. When you light a candle from the next, the first light certainly is not missing anything. It doesn't add anything to the second light, other than it, you know, makes the second light. The second light comes and we see it. And then a third, and then a fourth, etc. So, the power to create the second light obviously exists in the first light. And the first light, therefore, becomes the source of all things. That's how it is here. He says, when this first light emanates, and we call it the Keter, it has within it the potential, like a seed, of the nine lights to come. He says, don't be surprised that we say nine and not ten. He says, I'll explain it as he goes along. This first light, we said, is Ur Pashut, B'Tachlit HaPashitut. It is simple. Pure. The highest level of simplicity. And I always encourage people to remember the value of simplicity. Life is a complicated process. Whenever you have problems, simplify things. I've been a pastoral counselor now for 30 years, and people come to me with all kinds of problems. My partner doesn't do this, or this one doesn't do that, and this has that problem. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a PhD. I have no interest in that path. I'm out to make things simple. Somebody comes to me with pathologies, psychoses, and things like that, you send them to an appropriate medical professional. But people come to a rabbi with crises of life, crises of character. And I follow the great KISS rule. K-I-S-S. Keep it simple and straight. Simplify matters. That's calling going back to the source. I teach this in the Sefer Yetzirah, where it says if your mind runs and your mouth speaks, it says, Chozer, Shuv Lamakom. Go back to the place. Go back to simplicity. Like the verse says in Psalms, the Torah of Hashem is simple. It restores the soul. Simplify matters. Simplify your life. I got a problem. Well, what exactly is the problem? Well, the world isn't the way I like it. Gee, what else is new? Well, what can we do? Well, we can change the world. Let us completely change the world and recreate it in my image so that everything in existence goes according to me. Well, I guess if you're God, then that'll work. But just in case you're not suffering from illusions of grandeur and you're a mortal human being, kind of like me, we kind of recognize that ain't going to happen. So what can we do that is realistic? What can we do that will make your specific issue that is directly in front of you better? For example, I got a problem with my finances. Well, I got a great solution. Won't solve the problem 100%, but it'll help. Spend less money. How's that? This is actually recommended in the Talmud, Tractate Shabbat, in which we are taught, if and when you don't have the extra money to make your Sabbath meal special, then make it regular. Don't go around borrowing money. Don't go around taking public funds. Live within your means. Go with the flow. You're looking for a marriage partner, and there are people right here, right now, listening. Well, how do you practically, what do you got to do step by step to pursue it? There are always problems. There are always closed doors. And I recommend to people, rather than stand in front of a closed door waiting for it to open, move down the wall until you get to the door that is open. Somehow, somewhere, you'll walk through it, and somehow, somewhere, you'll know that that is right. So, I see that we've kind of ran out of time here. But I'm going to conclude with this one section here, and I guess then we will pick up and continue talking about Keter and Chochmah and all the rest as we go. So, this light, which is simple, pure, we say that this life is called nothing, because like the ultimate Ein Sof, the source of our being which connects to it is unknowable. It is the ultimate dark consciousness. If we're going to talk about dark matter, if we're going to talk about dark energy, I'm going to talk about dark consciousness. Is that unconscious? Gee, I don't know. Being that it's dark, it's kind of hard to describe, so just let it be what it is. And he says here that this is referred to in the verse where we recite in Psalm 121:1, right? I lift up my eyes to the mountains, from whence will come my help? The Hebrew word is me'ayin, yavo esri. Me'ayin, from whence? It actually means from nothing, from the ayin, from the ain. Will come my help. V'nikra ein, it's called ein, meaning ein machshiva musegit bo. Thought will never grasp it. Ad shekara'u ba'aleh avodah hazot. Alright, or ne'elam, or she'en musag lezerato. This is called the concealed light which only God can see. Human direction comes from a source higher than our conscious mind. In Jungian psychology, it is said that there is a teleological direction to psychological individuation. Something within us is guiding us to a higher fulfillment. That's what we need to be in touch with. Whether we're living in good times or bad, whether we're living in hard times or easy, whatever it is, this is our mission and purpose. Everything that I teach here at Kosher Torah is focused on this one task, to focus on connection. In our Torah tradition, this is actually called a halakha, a law. It is biblical. It is called in Hebrew devikut, or bonding with God. And we are said that those who bond with God are alive, everyone this day. Today we call it by different terms of meditation. I don't like such terms because I don't think that they're fully descriptive of what we need here. Meditation and bonding with God is helped by a period of silence and silent meditations in morning and at night, the likes of which I've explained in the essay online about the proper pronunciation of God's name. But it doesn't stop there. meditation of becoming aware of God. And what is God? Remember, we said it's the collective consciousness of the universe. And that means, if you want to become aware of God, let's define what that is. It means to be aware and to live in the awareness of knowing that everything is alive and that you are part of life. Like a part of the body which is flowing with the whole, like the cog in the machine. And you recognize that you are part of the greater whole and therefore flow with the movement of the natural greater body. And when you live like that, and you recognize that everything, for good, for bad, for up and down, and right and wrong, everything is part of the greater whole. This is the secret of Ein Od Milevado, there is nothing other than God. This is the reason why we proclaim day and night that Hashem, our God, Hashem is one. That there is a singularity of reality and we are just part of it. We are one with it in nature. We are one with it in life. We are one with it in the urban, rural, busy and unbusy times. The reason why I encourage people to get out of rural, urban areas and out of cities is because they are so overwhelmingly distracting that they don't enable you to see this. And it is ultimately essential for every human being to come and see beyond that which eyes can see. Okay. On that note, Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll pick up, we'll talk more about Keter, and we'll talk about Chochmah, which is the essential initial revelations of Keter, and how this process is what I call psychological. Because essentially, like we learned from My Flesh, I Come to See God, by learning and understanding our own inner psychodynamics, we recognize and can see the JPEG image of the greater whole of the universe, of everything. Because the universe is conscious, just as we are. We dealt within our own, we recognize our own, we come to see what is beyond. And recognize that the concept of us or I or own is far greater than you can possibly imagine. Okay, let's conclude it on that note. I thank you all for joining me. And again, I encourage your contributions and financial support to koshertorah.com in appreciation for our courses and learning. And I thank you in advance for your support. Thank you. I'll see you all in our next class. God bless. Shalom.